Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States v. Rollins. Mr. Deaton.
May it please the court. My name is Patrick Deaton. I'm a sole practitioner in St. Louis, Missouri. I represent Rudy Slack. Mr. Slack is currently serving three concurrent 108th-month sentences in the Bureau of Prisons as a result of three guilty verdicts following a 14-day jury trial in the Southern District of Illinois. Rudy Slack was convicted in count one of a conspiracy involving cocaine and cocaine base, count six on a distribution count involving cocaine powder, and in count seven, a distribution count involving cocaine base. Mr. Slack has alleged eight points of error in his brief. I don't propose to argue all of them today. The first alleged error was a Speedy Trial Act violation in which Rudy Slack is asking this court to remand the case because of the Speedy Trial Act violation so that the district court can hold a hearing on whether the dismissal should be with or without prejudice. He's asking the court to set aside his conviction on the conspiracy count for insufficient evidence and enter a judgment of acquittal on that count. Mr. Slack is arguing three evidentiary rulings that the trial court made and three sentencing errors. I'd like to begin this morning with one of the evidentiary issues that's common not only to Mr. Slack's appeal but also to Mr. Robbins' appeal. We've both briefed the issue. It regards the case agent's testimony. In appellant's briefs, we allege that the district court abused its discretion in allowing the case agent to testify to his impression, and that was the word that was used in the questions directed to the case agent. What is your impression? To allowing the case agent to testify to his impression of telephone calls that had been intercepted electronically and recorded under wiretap orders. Approximately 150 of these calls were played for the jury, and case agent McGarry, a DE agent, gave his impression of over 80 of these calls to the jury.
You know, isn't this the more calls that are recorded in here, there was at least 25 or so that involved your client and some 40 or so that involved the other defendant, Mr. Rollins here. The more calls, it would seem, the better position the agent is to offer his impression on as a lay witness on different things he's hearing, as opposed to just hearing one call. So doesn't it hurt you because he's heard so many calls?
No.
And he monitored every call.
I believe he did. I think the government, in its brief, said 24,000, there was something like 24,000 calls. And part of the foundation was Agent McGarry's testimony that he listened to calls, but he listened to more calls than just the calls played for the jury. So the danger, and
I guess what I'm saying is that the more calls you listen to, the more you get to know these people that he's monitoring, and I don't find it so unusual that he'd be able to form certain impressions about what is being said. Why that wouldn't be helpful to a jury to know that?
Two things would be wrong with that. First of all, the agent not testifying as an expert is testifying about information or impressions that he acquired, not just in the calls that are played for the jury, but in the many other calls that weren't introduced into evidence, consequently weren't played for the jury. I mean, it's just basic hearsay. It's as if the agent was on the stand saying to the jurors, jurors, I know a lot more about this case than what I've testified to. Trust me, these people are guilty.
Right, what's the most egregious impression that he offered to the jury? The question that was asked and the answer that was given.
A specific example that I mentioned in the brief, the government asked Agent McGarry, do you have an impression where Richard Pittman was getting his cocaine and who was helping him transport it? That kind of question goes beyond asking a witness to testify to the meaning of code words, to the meaning of language. He's testifying in that example and in other examples that I can't provide you right now to conduct that's consistent with the government's theory of the case, the timeline of how things were happening and, you know, what was going on, who was bringing drugs when, and so it went beyond the type of testimony that courts have allowed as expert testimony. But that brings me to the second point with Agent McGarry's testimony. This was offered as lay opinion testimony. So there was no disclosure ahead of trial that Agent McGarry was going to be testifying as an expert witness. So there's no disclosure to the defense, the procedural safeguards that are in Rule 16 don't apply when the testimony comes in under Rule 701. In the advisory committee comments to Rule 701, it cautions us to be careful not to allow Rule 701 to be used as an end around for expert testimony.
Mr. Deaton, of those many calls, including those that were not testified to that you referenced, were all of those calls available to the defense pretrial?
Yes.
So for the purposes of cross-examination, I'm not trying to take away from your point. There was no element of surprise connected with any of the testimony.
No, I disagree. Because with 702, there would have been a procedure where the agent would have had to disclose what his conclusions were and the kind of disclosures in advance so that we don't have trial by ambush or surprise. In this case, we simply had Agent McGarry get on the stand and start talking about his impression of what was happening in the telephone calls. We had no prior warning about that. Rudy Slack had filed a motion before trial asking the government to disclose any expert testimony that it had, and the only expert witnesses that were disclosed by the government were chemists, people that were going to come in and testify that the drugs were whatever they were.
Were there any summary charts or exhibits introduced?
Yes, there were. Regarding the phone calls?
Right. And I'm curious whether the testimony paralleled those summary charts.
You have probably seen an exhibit list that's part of the record here. And the exhibit list has a list of the calls and a brief description of the people speaking and what the call was about. That exhibit did not go to the jury. The jury didn't see that exhibit. So there was a summary prepared, but the jury didn't see that. I believe it was Agent McGarry testified to some other summaries, but they weren't summaries of the substance of the calls. They were simply summaries of the number of calls. You know, number of calls between Richard Pittman and either Mr. Rollins or his son. There were, I think, three or four exhibits prepared like that. Just the number of calls and the dates of the calls. The danger, and in my brief I cited to a Second Circuit case because the language of that case I thought was so on point to the circumstances in this case. In fact, I simply, in my brief, I quoted some of the language from that opinion because I couldn't express my argument any better than the judge did in that case. So the danger and the prejudice to Rudy Slack, you have a case in which the judge, I don't know if him and hawing is the right word, but the judge certainly had some concerns about the evidence connecting Rudy Slack to the conspiracy. You can see that in the transcript before the judge rules on the motion for judgment of acquittal at the close of the government's case, that that a witness like Agent McGarry is allowed to get on the witness stand and testify with the aura of an expert without having his testimony run through the procedural safeguards in Rule 16 and Rule 702. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Chief. Mr. Steele?
May it please the Court, my name is William Steele, Jr., and I represent James Rollins, Sr. James Rollins, Sr. was convicted on count one of conspiracy to distribute and count five with a count of distribution. I would like to take at least some of my time to also address the 701 and 702 issues here. Mr. Deaton was asked during his argument what was the most egregious example of this, and he cited what I think is the most egregious example, and it directly impacts on my client. And that's when Agent McGarry was allowed to offer his impression that Mr. Pittman was receiving his narcotics from my client. I can't think of an instance where a witness invades the province of a jury more than that, unless he's asked, sir, do you think the defendant's guilty or innocent? This directly goes to the ultimate fact, is my client distributing drugs? And this testimony is not based upon his having been an eyewitness to anything. It's based upon his impression, which essentially is a summary of what he's learned, what he thinks he's learned as the result of not only listening to these phone calls but also talking to other witnesses. Clearly, whether this was allowed under 701 or 702, it's testimony that should not have been admitted, and we believe the court erred in allowing it.
Didn't he make some admissions to that effect?
I'm sorry, sir?
Didn't your client admit in a statement to the agents that he had received drugs from Pittman?
My impression of his testimony was that it was fairly equivocal, or not his testimony, but his statement was that it was fairly equivocal. He did not, in that statement, say that he was delivering drugs, I don't believe, to Mr. Pittman. He did, according to the agent, say that he was picking up money, and the jury, of course, could believe that or not, depending on their impression of Agent McGarry's testimony. I think the aspect of this, though, that is most troubling for the defense is that Agent McGarry is given the opportunity to essentially say to the jury, for example, Mr. Pittman testified that these words mean money or drugs. And essentially McGarry is saying, he's right, you can believe him, because I'm telling you that. I'm a DEA agent. Clearly, that is not testimony that should be allowed to be admitted into this trial. In addition, we also believe that the testimony should not have been admitted as lay testimony, because we believe that it in fact was expert testimony. We have cited in our brief a couple of Second Circuit cases, Grimmage and Garcia, which we believe provides a good template for determining whether it's lay testimony or expert testimony. And the court in the Garcia case says that if the testimony is based upon specialized knowledge, if the record shows that the agent's expertise informed his challenge, his opinion, the opinion that's challenged, then it's expert testimony. And in failing to disclose this testimony to the defense, it deprived the defense of an opportunity to pretrial object to that testimony and perhaps have a fry hearing with regard to some of the conclusions that the agent would have drawn. But we were declined that opportunity. And those, I believe, are the, at least from our standpoint, the salient issues with regard to the 701 and 702 issue. I've also mentioned in the brief the issue of my clients having received a two-level increase under 2D1.1B1 for possession of a dangerous weapon. And I understand that the appellant has a difficult burden in attempting to overturn a decision like that. I would just mention to the court that while the government takes a position that there is no dispute as to possession, and that's correct, obviously, the gun was found there, but the gun was found a month after the government says the conspiracy concluded. There is nothing in the record evidencing that that gun was on the premises or anywhere near James Rollins during the course of the conspiracy. And with that, I'd like to reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Steele. Mr. Moore?
Thank you. If it pleases the court, my brother counsel, Mr. Deaton, and Mr. Steele, let's just cut to the chase right away with regards to Mr. McGarry. Mr. McGarry was never offered as a 702 expert. There is no notice requirement under 701. He was called for all purposes as a lay witness. There was no aura of expertise. What Mr. McGarry did, in fact, was he laid the foundation for the admission of the calls. And as the court has indicated, there were a total of 24,000 approximately calls on the wire. Actually, about 4,000 of those were pertinent to the drug enterprises of the defendants, and of those we took about, I think 150 is probably a fair assessment of what we played. But McGarry was never offered for expert purposes. He had no scientific knowledge, he had no extra education. What he had was, from day one, he was in the wire room listening to those people on the phone, getting to know who was who, getting to know what they were talking about, getting to know when drug deliveries were going to be made, and when the drug deliveries were going to be made, when shipments were coming through, being dropped off at Mr. Rollins' house, they sent out other law enforcement agents and sometimes McGarry to do the surveillance. Now, they didn't arrest anybody at the time because they didn't want to burn the investigation, but Mr. McGarry's involvement is an intimate familiarity with both the phone calls and all of the other law enforcement activities, the surveillance, the background, and such like with regard to the entire investigation. So he identifies the participants. He identifies the dates and the time of the calls, and he puts the calls in context for the jury. He does say, here's what we've got. We've got a call. We've got a load of big kids coming in, and so they go out, and they see, indeed, they see a truck coming from Rollins Jr.'s trucking company in California, driven by one of the guys, dropping stuff off They know that Mr. Pittman and Mr. Rollins Sr. are in constant telephone contact. And incidentally, the summary exhibits can be found as Exhibit D in our appendix in our brief that lay out the number of calls between the various parties. So he identifies the participants, he identifies the days and date of the call, he puts the contact call in the context of the surveillance, and he also puts them in the context of what phones are being overheard, because we have 10 different phones that are being overheard, so we have to tie the phones to a particular conversation. It was from the very beginning clear to everybody that we were not offering anybody under 702, and I want to talk just a little bit about the question of preservation of the issues as to Mr. Deaton's client, Rudy Slack, because we pointed out in our brief that there was no specific objection made, and Mr. Slack in his reply brief says the court during jury selection agrees that an objection of one attorney for jury selection is an objection for all. And from there he makes the quantum leap that if somebody objected during trial, that objection inures to Mr. Slack. And that's just plain not the fact. The transcript, which is provided in the reply brief, indicates very clearly that that agreement, that ground rule that counsel talks about, was in fact simply a ground rule for jury selection. We had five defendants and eight lawyers in the courtroom, and jury selection was a long and arduous process, and so that was the ground rule for jury selection. I want to talk just briefly about speedy trial. Mr. Slack has raised the issue of speedy trial. Judge Herndon's order is pretty succinct in that not a single day had run on the speedy trial term at the time that trial commenced. There was no motion for severance. Now, Mr. Slack was in jail for a long time, but there was a long time where we had folks who were out as fugitives, and the period beginning from when the last person was arraigned was covered with a multiplicity of pending motions. Those are also found as an exhibit in our appendix. There wasn't a single day that was not excluded during the time under the statute. And I do note that the statute, things might have been different had Mr. Slack made a motion for severance and been successful.
What's your position on the guideline determinations regarding Kimbrough?
Well, I think Judge Herndon was pretty clear in talking about the sentences. He dealt extensively with the sentencing statute and said the first thing we do is we establish what the correct guidelines are, but that's simply to advise us. And then he moved on. He ticked off all the factors under 3553A. He ticks off all of the factors that he feels are salient, and he discusses them at length. If I understand the import of counsel's argument that Judge Herndon did not treat the guidelines as advisory, I think that's belied by the transcript, which very clearly indicates.
Well, but every district judge at the time knew that he couldn't poo-poo this 100-to-1 ratio you had.
With regard to that, I think we can see that to the extent that he falls within, you will recall that these briefs were submitted prior to the March 3rd change, and we can see that if he falls within the ambit of the new crack guidelines.
My question, do you agree that he is entitled to a remand
for consideration?
Taylor,
yes.
Now, but it's for Palladino.
Yeah, I agree that he's entitled to remand for consideration on that limited issue, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And if Your Honors have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. Deaton.
Thank you. As to the waiver issue, I filed a reply brief because I wanted to show the court all the points where this issue was exhaustively litigated. And at no point. I have Judge Herndon's language. There was no mention of jury selection when he was announcing as a grand rule of trial that an objection for one defendant would be an objection for all the defendants.
Well, that's pretty standard that there, in multi-defendant trials, that it, the judge would like one objection to stand for everybody. I think that we would probably not agree with the government's counsel.
Rudy Slack was number seven, so you could see where I was and where I was going to be in the list. The language of this court's decision in Ross was so close to what Judge Herndon said. And it wasn't that Judge Herndon didn't acknowledge at sentencing that he could sentence outside the guidelines. It was that Judge Herndon at sentencing accorded the guidelines for crack cocaine a presumption of reasonableness because they coincided with a ratio, the 100-to-1 ratio, that Congress was using in setting the statutory mandatory minimums for the offenses. I see that my red light is on.
Well, if you had one additional thought, you may make it, Mr. Beaton.
Yes, I do. This idea that Agent McGarry could testify as a lay witness, it's just the sort of thing that the committee comments in Rule 701 say is wrong. It talks about this kind of testimony. When a chemist testifies to his opinion that a drug is a certain sort of thing, we can cross-examine that chemist about what procedures, what methodology did he use to arrive at that conclusion. We have no indication what kind of methodology that Agent McGarry used to form the impressions that he testified about in this case.
Eden, if Agent McGarry had been a member of the conspiracy, perhaps loading or unloading, and related all and was and pled, for example, cooperated and related all these conversations that he heard. Of course, you're hearing by tape in the reality of this case. Would that have been allowed?
I can't answer that directly, yes or no. So bear with me for just about a half a minute. Agent McGarry was not a participant in the telephone conversations. You're posing a hypothetical in which the witness is at least a participant in some of the conversations.
Well, not a participant, but just overhearing him. In other words, he's in attendance when these conversations go down. I mean, assuming these conversations are not telephonic, they're in a setting where he hears them.
Well,
lay witness testifying to conversations between two others, or if it's on a speakerphone, you can play with the hypothetical as you will. I'm just trying to see what the limits of this lay testimony could be.
Well, one limit is that a person has to be a participant. Then there's the so-called co-conspirator,
right.
hearsay exception that someone who's a member of the conspiracy can testify about acts in furtherance of the conspiracy, and that sounds like where that would fall.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Deaton.
You're welcome.
Mr. Steele.
Your Honor, if I could pick up on where Mr. Deaton left off, to address your example, I believe that, yes, Agent McGarry could testify about conversations he heard, as long as those conversations, as Mr. Deaton said, were by co-conspirators in the furtherance of the conspiracy. What he would not be able to testify about is what that other person meant. And that's what we have here. And that is why I believe the court erred here, because it allowed Agent McGarry to testify not only about what these words meant, but in looking over my notes, I realized he not only said that Mr. Rollins Sr. was selling, his impression was Mr. Rollins Sr. was selling cocaine to Mr. Pittman. His impression also was that he was getting it from Rollins Jr. Clearly that's inappropriate. Clearly it's improper. and we believe it is not harmless error. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steele. Thanks to all counsel. Mr. Steele and Mr. Deaton, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting these appointments and presenting the arguments this morning.
Thank you, sir.
Case is taken under advisement.